thatgreatbusinessshow.com is brought to you by DeFacto Shaving Oil, the best anyone can get. Made in Ireland, sold worldwide.
Welcome to the Business Show podcast, but not any old business show. No, this is That Great Business Show, Ireland's best business podcast. I'm your host, Conal Moran. On this episode, number 38, we have four fab stories. We bet when you were in school, your career guidance counsellor said you should be a nurse, accountant, or work in IT, maybe. We also bet they never, ever mentioned foraging for a living. That's why we have a forager in the house. Everybody in Ireland knows McCambridge's bread, but not too many know the story behind this iconic brand. Stay with us to hear how to create a bread brand. Way back on episode 4, we had a logistics expert forecast, correctly, that we'd be buying smaller turkeys for Christmas. Now, with the Brexit temperature being turned up again, he's here to tell us about a world shortage of ketchup sachets. And also on our busy little show, we have a brand new software designed specifically to win your business big contracts and save you wasting your time pitching for the unobtainable. As always, That Great Business Show is brought to you by De Facto Shaving Oil, the world's best shaving oil, made in Mayo, sold worldwide.
That Great Business Show.
One of the biggest pain points for any business is finding customers, but equally, it's a pain trying to locate the right suppliers that will meet your company's exact requirements. Brand new software startup Sluamore, that's S-L-U-A-M-O-R, may be about to ease those pains. Their clever bit of kit can find more qualified sales leads so that you can sell more products and services and make more money for you and your business. And on the other side, Sluamore can free up your procurement team by accessing a wider variety of suppliers that they have found and assessed for you as being suitably qualified to supply your business. Jamaican-born Tanya Thompson is the boss at Sluamore, and she was telling me that her real passion was rally driving around Montego Bay. So, Tanya Thompson, let's start with that. First of all, welcome to That Great Business Show.
Welcome, and thank you very much, Conal. I'm still laughing at the one. I'm not really the boss. I'm the CTO, not the CEO. And the rally driving around Montego Bay, geez.
Would you prefer to be World Rally Champion or CTO of Sluamore?
Oh my gosh. I think at this stage of my life, yes, I'm perfectly placed in terms of being a CTO for Sluamore. If you'd asked me that question maybe in my 20s, yeah, I might have given you a different answer.
That's only about 5 years ago, isn't that right?
Oh, I wish.
Sluamore, first of all, lovely name. Slua means crowd, more, big crowd.
Big crowd.
But it's got a reason to be called Sluamore.
Yes, it is. Sluamore is a two-sided marketplace for buyers and suppliers. It helps them to complete B2B deals faster, more efficiently, and with a greater sense of success. And what we're aiming to do is to build a subscriber base that is so significant, you know, trying to get to 5 to 10,000 within the next 3 years so that it can sustain itself. Suppliers can find the buyers that they need, and likewise, buyers can actually find suppliers to provide the products and services they actually need for their business.
Talk me through a case study.
A good case study. We have Health Stores Ireland, for example, is currently using the platform. They have put in place a supplier development program focused on local Irish suppliers. It's called Guaranteed Healthy, which is very aligned to their, you know, their brand. And they're looking for local, new, innovative local suppliers who can provide them products for their over 100 retailers, you know, across Ireland. And they've been, they've used Sluamore so far to get a goat's milk butter producer on board. They've gotten specialty dairy producers. They're looking for, you know, and they've been rolling this out over the next few months, trying to get different kinds of suppliers for their businesses, which is a perfect opportunity for SMEs.
What about if I were another goat milk butter supplier. Can I get on as well? And am I given equality or parity of esteem or whatever you want?
Yeah, it's really simple. Once they have an opportunity promoted on the platform, you just simply subscribe to the platform and then submit your proposal. It's a very straightforward process. We've deliberately made it that way. It's a subscription model, so you do have to pay to subscribe, but you don't need to pay to actually assess if the opportunity is relevant for you. As a local supplier within Ireland, especially if you're new and you're uncertain, you don't feel that you're a good fit to the likes of Aldi or Lidl, it would be a very great opportunity for you. They're not expecting you to go out to 100 retailers in one go. You know, it could be just one retailer and then scaling as your business or you feel that your business is capable.
Where did this idea come from?
This is all coming from Health Stores Ireland. This has nothing to do with Slowmore. We're just a conduit, a channel that they've actually chosen to actually use to promote their guaranteed healthy program. And the reason they're actually using Slowmore is because as SMEs, they're not, you know, platforms that actually are typically used, you know, to go out to suppliers are that much more expensive. We provided a very affordable platform so that they can actually use and
what is affordable? every person's affordable is different.
Well, that is very true. We genuinely think our platform is affordable for suppliers. For example, just to respond to opportunities within a platform, you're talking about $144 per year. That's less than 40 cents per day.
€144.
Yes, exactly.
I was wondering whether you meant €1.44.
No,
not that.
€144 per year.
It doesn't matter, but that's an interesting number.
Yeah.
It's obviously 12 times 12.
Yes.
Where did it come from?
We would have gone out to the market and done a lot of assessment, talking to various customers as to what they would deem affordable. For some suppliers, I'm not kidding you, they, especially the smaller ones, they would have said, you know, that's really hard for me to find at the moment, especially since COVID. But for the opportunity of the sales opportunity and the revenue that is a potential for their business and the growth opportunity that translates into over years, they're willing to make that. You know, when you think about it,
they'd be mad not to. Is that what you're going to tell me?
They'd be. I mean, when you compare to if you're using for example, LinkedIn Sales Navigator, it costs more. You know, if you're doing campaigns on Facebook every month, it costs more. Marketing spend for business to B2B companies is in around the range of 7 to 9% of their revenue each year. So $144 per year for potentially guaranteed sales, live sales opportunities, real sales opportunities is huge. It's worth it.
Now, you are early stage.
Yes.
How early stage are you?
We're 3 years old, but we've spent the first 2 years building out the platform. And, it was actually a bit sad when COVID happened because we were feeling ready to actually launch and to attend lots of events, you know, in person and get the message out there. Of course, COVID happened, so therefore we had to scale back a little bit and rethink how we actually went to the market. And that's what we've actually been doing. But so in reality, we're pretty much in the marketplace since 2020.
Buyers, suppliers, how many of each might you have?
I would say you could say it's probably like a 1 to 10, you know, buyers versus supplier mix. Buyers, you know, you'll find more suppliers coming on board because of the live sales opportunities. And we also have suppliers actually coming on board for the potential of actually finding out and learning about the sales opportunities that come across, you know, come on board our platform at the right time. When you think about it, you know, in reality, getting sales leads is hard. It's difficult. HubSpot says it's like 40% of people struggle to find new customers. I remember doing this when I was back in PwC. It's not an easy road. So we are giving them the opportunity to learn about when people are really looking for those opportunities rather than having to do that grunt work.
I used to do it when I was stockbroking, and I almost used to vomit.
Yes.
I mean, I'm not shy, but I hated making those cold calls.
And exactly. I'm the exact same. And we recognize those pain points. We had we have still a company called Keystone Procurement. And that's where the idea kind of resonated, because people kept asking, isn't there something like e-tenders for the private sector as private buyers, as private sector suppliers? And we said, you know, I wasn't involved in the business at the time. And Ross McCarthy, the CEO, said to my colleague, Donica Phelan, you know, this is something we could definitely look into. And that's pretty much it. We worked on that concept from
and
then.
Ross McCarthy's name resonates because that is an ISME connection. Is that right? And you are working with ISME.
Yes, he is. He was the ISME chair. He is no longer that, but he's retained his seat on the National Council. So he's been advocating the rights of and lobbying for SMEs for quite some time prior to becoming the chair, as well as since then.
And ISME, though, you are trying to do work with them directly, am I right? Or you're offering the service?
Well, ISME, I suppose because Ross was on the platform and he'd be talking about, you know, Slowmore over the years, and I would have been participating in their Back to Business program as well as part of, you know, during COVID, which was a great initiative they had in terms of getting SMEs to be marketing their products and services, regardless of what was happening at the time. And I suppose they would have learned about Slowmore because we were, you know, marketing ourselves. And they thought, why not use the platform? So they have actually been using it to source trainers for their ISME SkillNet program. ISME, through that program, they're providing lots of different kinds of training for SMEs, sales training, which we all could use from time to time, HR management training, CRM training. So they've used it not you know, because of the procurement compliance requirements that they actually have to, you know, deal with, because, you know, they have to report to the SkillNet Ireland that they're actually being open and transparent about the process by which they actually get trainers on board.
Are we talking Ireland only, or have you got world ambitions?
We have world ambitions indeed. That's one of the things that New Frontiers has been brilliant about. They've been pushing us beyond what we would probably have initially envisaged.
That is the New Frontiers program that you have just completed?
I've just completed that. So my last pitch was on Monday, and we have some videos circulating that I might cringe a little bit, but I think I've heard that they're okay. And but yeah, it's an entrepreneurship program backed by Enterprise Ireland, and it's all around helping companies like Slowmore to really understand what the market is, you know, the market opportunity, understand the size of the market opportunity, understand how much they can actually grow, and to help them to get investor ready so that, you know, whatever pitch documents, whatever business plans they actually need to have in place, they will have on board so that they can get any funding that they might need.
And thank you for lining this up for me, because you are looking for investors.
We are indeed looking for investors. So we're looking for we're trying to raise 500,000 seed round, and we're hoping to do that within the next few months.
Wow.
Yes.
That's quick. Have you much in the bag already? Or
We've had a few bites, but we haven't nailed anything down as yet.
That's the difficult part, I can tell you now. Fish tend to bite a bit, but trying to reel them in, okay.
Yes, that's exactly it. And we've entered the seed corn competition. I probably shouldn't say, just in case we don't actually get shortlisted, but we've entered the seed corn competition that we can actually raise our profile in that respect as well.
And I so tell people, enter every competition because you get free publicity.
Yeah.
And with seed corn, you might get, is it 250,000 or something? I mean, it's a big, big prize anyway.
There's a good prize. I think it's in the 200 regions. To be quite honest, I'm not even concerned about how much funding that we can actually get. But it's more around trying to get onto the radar of investors so we can actually start to hopefully, you know, tweak their interest and start to have more in-depth conversations.
And ordinary question to ask you, and I presume you've done your homework on this, are there others out in the market doing something similar to you, what you're doing?
I would definitely. I mean, there are different kinds of companies all across the world, but we believe and we see ourselves as primarily, you know, focused on SMEs, which our competitors wouldn't be. We made sure that it's affordable. Unlike a lot of our competitors, they're primarily focused on buyers. For example, I'm not going to name names, actually, I shouldn't, but they're primarily focused on buyers. We're trying to create an even place, a true marketplace, kind of like Amazon, really, when you think about it. It's just that we're not, we're not selling products, and we're not, you know, and it's not just products that people are actually, you know, trying to get with, you know, or sell on our platform. It's around services, which are very, you know, selling products associated with services or services only is much more complicated than consumer purchasing or buying and selling.
And if I am making, because it's easier to think about it in this way, bars of soap, how quickly can I ring up Slow More and see my product on offer up there?
Well, you don't have to ring Slow More at all if you want bars of soap, although I probably say just go to the supermarket. But if it's just a few bars of soap we're talking about.
No, I'm selling them, remember.
But in terms of Slow More, it's more a buyer-driven platform rather than a supplier-driven. So if you are a buyer looking for tons of, you know, soap, right? Then you actually go onto the platform, you subscribe, subscribe to a paid plan, preferably, and you advertise the nature of services you need and the terms associated with that, you know. So whatever
now,
delivery
terms
and all of that.
One of the issues around tendering is always the paperwork. Have you simplified the paperwork?
We've pretty much simplified the paperwork. The whole idea is we provide a framework that you actually outline specifically what it is that you're looking for. It's very straightforward. It's simple. It can be used for complex procurement. It can be used for simple purchasing. And then basically then it's available within the platform. Suppliers can get alerts of those opportunities if they're related to any products and services that they are particularly selling. And then they can then respond in like a very simple process as well. You can attach as many documents as you need, which is part of the way that we've actually made it straightforward. And then if you're also kind of prospecting, you know, we've actually aggregated public sector data out there in the EU space. I mean, it's not currently available, but we'll be having it in place by the end of this month. So you can actually be using it as a buyer or supplier to actually, you know, just type in what you're buying or selling, and then we'll indicate possible buyer supplier choices that have been vetted by the public sector across the EU. So you can actually look at those as well as possible, source contacts.
My heart sinks, though, when I hear about that. Do you know why? The requirements way too often for ridiculous amounts of insurances. And insurances that probably aren't even around at the moment. And yet people are insisting on 12 million and 16 million or 20 million cover for something that might only be worth, you know, a couple of hundred thousand. Mad.
Insurance is a huge problem for, I think, all businesses, not just SMEs, but it is particularly important for SMEs. You know, as part of one of the things that ISME has been actually doing and been doing through our platform is trying to basically help those companies who are crying out in pain around the significant increases in insurance premiums. And they've been offering the opportunity to join schemes for different groups of suppliers, whether it be architects, engineers and whatnot, who have been particularly hurt over the last few years. And they can actually register, use a platform and indicate their interest in joining one of these insurance schemes, so that the insurance broker that actually is me sourced through our platform can actually advocate on their behalf to get either lower premiums or, even more importantly, just guarantee of insurance, because that's the problem that people are having.
Final question. You're higher in a heartbeat.
I would. It's a very hard question for me because the first person I would think about is my mom, because she's been my source of strength over the years, even though she's no longer alive. But I just wouldn't see her as a hire just because she was never in business. So even though she's a strong woman. But the person I'd probably say is Oprah. I mean, I grew up watching her, and she has come from, you know, a poverty-ridden home. She was raped. She was a teenage mother, and she's really overcome, evolved herself, overcome lots of adversities to become a worldwide brand. I mean, she's, if Slowmore got to even a tenth, maybe even a hundredth of that level in terms of our brand is recognized the world, I would be like, yes, I'd be so delighted.
Sounds like a good choice. Tanya, if anybody wants to find you and give you a 500,000, that's all you're looking for, where will they find you?
Feel free to just, we have a contact page on Slowmore, just drop us a note, and it's slowmore.com, slumor.com.
Cool. Tanya.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for joining us on That Great Business Show.
Thanks a lot, Conal.
Subscribe today to That Great Business Show on your favorite podcast platform, including Apple and Spotify.
Do you know what happens to all of those empty shaving foam cans? In Ireland, 20 million of them are sent to landfill every year because they're officially hazardous waste. This landfill pollution is completely unnecessary. One bottle of de facto shaving oil is the equivalent of 10 cans of shaving foam. So switching from foam to the world's best shaving oil is the simplest thing you could do to help keep our planet clean. DeFactoShave.com, saving the planet one shave at a time.
That Great Business Show.
Now, what are the staples we all miss when we're exiled overseas for a while? Potato, of course, and I've recently been asked to send Ballymaloe relish to Australia. And of course, there's Barry's tea, Clonakilty sausages and black pud, and Kerrygold butter generously smeared over McCambridge's brown bread. All great Irish food brands. I was doing some work recently presenting a series of Lovin' Irish Food podcasts when, for the first time, I met with Michael McCambridge of the eponymously named bread company, and I took the opportunity to ask him to join us on That Great Business Show, and happily he said yes. So, welcome to That Great Business Show, Michael McCambridge.
Hi, Conal. Nice to see you.
Michael, you're 75 years, I think, odd in business, isn't that right? How does one make a bread into a brand? Because, not being disrespectful, a bread is a bread.
Yeah. I think one of the key things in the Irish market is family connection and an approach which remains true to the core of the product you're baking. But in our case, we've been at this since 1945. So a brand doesn't get born, it evolves. And along the way, many brands take a wrong turn and recover. Some don't. We've taken a few wrong turns, but we've repeated our message from when we started around the family connection, a tradition made fresh every day. And also we haven't moved away from the core of Irish brown bread to work with the modern logistics, which are very tough on fresh products. So particularly now, and I'm talking about the last 5 years in terms of the life of the brand, which is 75 years old. The last 5 years, people are moving towards products which are not as processed. And we're fortunate that our product is Irish brown bread, is not processed. So we'd be foolish to move away from that. So it's sticking to the core. The second thing in brand evolution is repeating the message, but not boring your consumers. So having some entertainment in your communication, whether it's social media, print, or above the line on radio and TV, we recorded a piece of music which is associated with McCambridge, and that goes with the brand stories. So the dialogue in the ad, the message in the ad and the music all come together to give somebody, our customers, a feeling of what McCambridge is. So what you're looking to achieve in a brand is to give people a brand persona. They visualize a brand as somebody having these qualities. And that's really important, particularly in a food brand.
Do you know what I like? The taste.
I didn't mention that. Yeah, well, thank you.
I know, I do. I love it. I mean, I'm just a big fan.
Yeah, well, it's a little bit of a simple story because we haven't done anything to the product. It's originated in County Mayo. And as you know, Irish flour and wheat has a lower protein level than other flour and wheats from around the world because of the weather conditions. And Irish bread doesn't need high protein. wheat. So we use Irish wholemeal flour. We use Irish fresh buttermilk, which was a waste product from making buttermilk, and the bread soda and a few of the magic ingredients, which gives that unique taste to the product. And it's really core for us as we grow our business and grow our plant and equipment, that the plant and equipment does not change the nature of the product. And we're getting into texture, you know, crust and so on, because that's exactly what, to be quite frank, my grandmother made back in 1945, and we have to stay true to that, and that's the taste.
And was she in Mayo?
She originated in Mayo.
From where?
From a small town called Kilmaine, between Ballinrobe and Galway on the Headford Road. She then moved into Galway with my grandfather. She was a Murphy McCambridge, and he worked in the McCambridge shop in Shop Street with his brother, and then he moved to Dublin with my grandmother and my father and my aunt to set up a shop in Renle in 1945. So going back to your branding question, we have a lot of people we still meet who remember the shop in Renle. In fact, if I could say, we met a lady recently not too far from here who was at the opening as a 13-year-old girl.
Wow.
And she recanted what she had with a cup of tea and some sponge cake with Mr. and Mrs. McCambridge back in June 1945. Still alive.
But even the idea that you'd have an opening back in 1945. Yeah. I mean, there was another thing going on at the time. It was called the Second
World
War.
That's right. Yeah, and things were tough.
Oh, you bet. Yeah,
But that goes back to where the brand is. And that, you know, it's very hard to start a brand. And, you know, full marks of those who have done in the last 5-6 years. I've been fortunate I inherited the work that others had done.
Ah, but you also had to keep it going because there is competition out there, I believe.
Yeah, it's quite heavy going.
And speaking of competition, one of the things that has or can happen is people try to make their product look like yours.
Yeah, well.
Go on, tell us the story.
Well, people have very little time in the store, and they really are shopping nearly by colour and immediate recognition because they've tasted and they have a list and they need to get back to the car to bring the kids to their classes at their sports venues. So in a supermarket environment, funnily, less so in online, which is moving now in that direction, but in a supermarket environment, it's speed and recognition. And you will notice that a lot of products in the freezer section, talking about, say, frozen fish, they're all light blue, okay? And they're not the same size packs, but the main difference is the signature brand message on them. So we've been very clear, probably in the mid-2000s, that we moved away from just McCambridge to use the John McCambridge signature because...
Who was your...
My father.
Father, okay.
And that's like the provenance on a painting, as far as I'm concerned. And you'd want to have quite a thick neck to copy that signature. But everything else is really up for grabs. However, if you get to a point where it's determined that it's passing off, and creates what they call customer confusion, then you may have crossed over the boundary of intellectual property.
And somebody may have done that.
They may have. There was a case back in 2011 or so between ourselves
and
another bakery.
A great big case. I mean, I know enough about law, is that must have eaten up your time and resources in a huge way.
It did. I explained it in another interview that really what it was a commercial dispute that had to be arbitrated by a court. We couldn't get agreement. So the two good companies went for third party adjudication. That's as simple. Now, it did go to the High Court. It did then go to the Supreme Court. And we got a victory of 4-1 of the Supreme Court, which really positioned the brand well. So we now have a nice protective ring around the brand so that others would be very careful to go near it. And that case is now part of the syllabus in the law degrees around the country, which is great.
Reminds them to buy their McCambridges.
There's a little message there, below the line marketing.
So how many people are you employing now?
We're employing 50 people. And our bakery is based in Dublin out in Rathcoole, which gives us great access to the motorway system.
And then distributed across the island?
Across the island, the fresh bread on a 7-day basis.
Now, isn't that the next problem? Is we all love to see, and I'd love to see it for you, is that you can get into the UK, maybe even further abroad, but it ain't going to happen.
I don't know of any fresh bread that's exported successfully. You know, there's product, Cuisine de France made a fantastic innovation back in the mid-90s, par bacon frozen, and that was a real solution for food on the go. But actually, you know, fresh bread, whether it's Poulain in Paris, they've opened up a little bakery in London. They can't send it across profitably, and your product integrity suffers. You can't get freshness. There's too much risk in the supply chain. So it is a limiting factor for fresh bread bakeries in Ireland.
Could you backpack it and ship it, say, to London and distribute it?
Good question. You couldn't, because the bread is of such a nature, a bit of an anorak comment here, but when you vac pack it, it doesn't recover its shape.
Okay.
Other breads do, but you've taken the air out and it stays compressed.
And that's not what we want.
No, no. Frozen is an option, but you know, people don't buy bread from the frozen section. So really what we've done to gain exports is break the baked product down into its constituent elements, sell it as a mix with added benefits. Which includes a baking tray and a mixing bag inside. So really, you don't need anything else other than some milk from your fridge, and it doesn't have to be buttermilk. So we're doing a bit of export of that into the UK with Amazon, particularly more since the COVID
much
issue.
Of a pickup on that?
Huge.
Oh, was there?
Well, I think this time last year, we were number one or two in the bread and bread mixes category in Amazon UK. And at the moment, because COVID isn't such, and home baking isn't such high on the agenda, we're at number 8 on the top 100 breads and bread mixes in Amazon UK. So that's a very solid business.
Why would you drop from 1 to 8 if it's still being done?
It's the people who were always buying mixes are still buying mixes.
Okay.
The people who changed the behaviour during COVID have gone back to their stores. So they're not baking at home as much as they would have this time last year. But for me, top 10 is great, and we're looking to build on that. And we've just started with Amazon US, which is a totally different system. And we have our Irish soda bread mix in the US selling out of the Chicago Amazon warehouse. Small volumes, we're not pushing it, but we'll be following it with other products which are equally as relevant to the US market, scones and scone mixes and such like.
How do you market into the vast US market through Amazon? Or
there's two ways. We're using one at the moment, which is using the Amazon advertising system. So they have packages and parcels of options whereby you can get parts of the page that people visit for mixes and put you as a headline, like a notice board or a sign on top of a shop. You know, go here for your Irish bread mix. You can do specials like you would in a supermarket on price. Probably the more powerful method is to actually work with a media agency. We use one in Ireland. And the beauty of social media now is you can use a media agency in Dublin who can target people in the US and work with the online Irish media, Irish Post, for example, Central Irish, but also using the Instagram and Facebook consumer profiles to target people who might be interested. We did that in the UK and we saw a phenomenal increase.
Did you use influencers or known Irish faces?
No,
or?
We haven't done that yet, actually. All we did was use Facebook, Instagram and Twitter. And our media company was able to target consumers who might be interested without bombarding them, saying, by the way, this is available. Do you want to try it? And volume went through the roof. So the best thing about that sort of online digital activity is it's very, very trackable.
It is alleged, and I'm sure it's untrue, that if you're very, very, very successful on Amazon, that they take an inordinate interest in your product, and they sometimes it is alleged they might try to replicate it. Would Amazon, Amazon brand bread sound right?
I think that is true, and in fact, you know, that's been true going back in time of commercial activity, and Amazon is a behemoth. So if it works, they're going to try and present their own option. With regard to the US, believe it or not, Irish bread is a small niche within a niche. There was about 90,000 to 100,000 searches for Irish bread mixes on Amazon US last year. So we know that through our digital research.
Yeah.
Other products we're going to launch, there's been over 2 million searches. So it's unlikely they'll copy the Irish bread, because within all the bread that's available of the cultural mix in the US, it's probably not a huge volume product.
So back to the key market, which is the island here.
Yeah.
Can you grow it further, or what can you do?
Yeah, absolutely. We've actually introduced 3 new variants. I say new in the last few years, but things evolve. These products were with us for a while. And we have our core product, which is the coarse wholemeal with Canty Mayo recipe. And actually, that is a very, very coarse flour. It's an acquired taste, really high in fibre, no added sugar.
Is there salt in it?
There's salt because it's a soda bread. Yeah. So, you know,
I love it.
Yeah.
As I said.
And it's a balanced diet. So people say, oh, there's too much salt in Irish bread.
No,
but that's the bicarbonate of soda, you know. But if you go to different parts of the country, they like a lighter soda bread, like a round soda bread. We have three different soda breads out there, which I was looking at today before I came out. And we're seeing at the moment, you know, some very strong double-digit growth. Now,
I'm sorry, are you telling me, just to understand this, is that there's a different choice of flavour, say, in Munster to Ulster or something like that?
You put your finger on it there. I'm glad you said Munster and Ulster. Because,
I just chose to be served the first
you
part.
Know, this hasn't been rehearsed, but, you know, in Ulster, a soda bread's called a wheaton. If I go to Ulster and try and sell soda bread, they'll say it should be white flour bread. If I go into Munster, a soda bread is called a soda, yeah? In the East, it's called whole wheat. You know, or brown bread. So we're a small country.
A tiny little island.
Absolutely. You know, there's regional variances. You know, in Connacht, we've noticed that the round soda is a seller, whereas in the East, it's not a seller. So, yeah, you know, we have a 30% market share.
Of?
So on the Irish traditional soda bread.
Okay.
Which means we don't have 70. So there's a lot of people buying bread out there that's not McCambridge. So we've got to go after it.
Actually, I do like your thinking because that is exactly it. The market, there's plenty more of the market to win.
To win. And if we can continue to emphasise the category value, so not just McCambridge brand, but Irish brown bread taken as part of a moderate diet is good for you. So encourage more people to eat Irish brown bread. If we've got 30% of every new customer base, 10, 12, 20, you know, we have our 3 to 6 more customers because there is a traditional element to it. And, you know, as life is life, people are moving off this planet and they're not buying McCambridge bread anymore. So we have to replace them.
Did you tell me, and maybe I'm wrong on this because I have been wrong before, your machinery, is it of an age?
No, it's quite modern, actually.
Somebody was telling me about some machinery that they were using that could have been 100 years old. That's not
Not me. No, we've actually moved from when I was baking as a student, you know, baking by hand because the volumes are, we've been able to buy machinery from around Europe because there's no machinery solution for Irish soda bread. There's not a market for engineers to develop this. Mm-hmm. So we've typically gone to France where they have a good bread culture and bought machinery which is very, very gentle on our product. The last thing we want to do is retreat it with loads of energy, which you need for yeast bread, but for soda bread you don't. So no, our machinery is quite modern and we continue to invest in it because we need to keep our efficiency levels up because, sorry to mention it today, but inflation is rampant and we need to keep our cost bases.
We were just talking about inflation. Inflation is coming our way.
Coming our way, and it's hard to recover in the grocery market, understandably. Food has never been as good value for consumers. So we've got to
buy
find
it now. Yeah, stores, freeze it.
Yeah, if you could. So we've got to find our savings internally.
I also see that you are with the German multiples.
Yes.
Was that a big decision to take?
Coming back to my point about 30% market share not being in 70. No, the logic is there. We
if
should be
there.
Saying,
you have to be
we
there.
Have to be there. That, you know, we're a good brand. We need to be there. We're a brand supplier in one of them. We're not a branded supplier in the other because they don't carry a lot of brands. But no, the logic is
you're
there.
You're branded with Lidl.
With Lidl,
remember,
correct? Yeah.
See,
well done.
I do my little bit.
Yeah,
of
you do. Yeah. So no, I think from a, if I often take a perspective that if someone walked into the office and asked the question, "Why aren't you supplying 11% of the market, which is one of the German retailers," there's no business reason for not doing it unless the terms don't work. Mm-hmm. So you got to make sure terms work with any customer. So not being preferential or so, but no, it's business. We need to be selling in there in as many outlets as we can in Ireland and as many channels as possible.
I have to give another shout out to Lidl because they are also now carrying Brady's Coffee, and Brady's Coffee were on that Great Business Show and it is gorgeous.
Really? I must try it.
Absolutely gorgeous. $3.99 per packet and
in
it's
Lidl.
Just nicer. Before I let you go, who would you hire in a heartbeat?
Okay, I've thought about this and it's not Warren Buffett or Michael O'Leary or all those guys who are in the press or writing books. The key word in the question for me is heartbeat. Who would I hire in a heartbeat? I'd hire John and Maureen McCambridge as my non-executive directors.
And that is the?
They're my mum and dad who were in the business.
Yeah.
And they passed away quite young.
Oh.
So I'd like to bring them back to sit on the board and direct us.
They wouldn't be very happy with it.
Well, listen, I look at other great family businesses in Ireland, you know, like, you know, you mentioned Ballymaloe, Maxine Hyde and her mum in there and the Flanagan family, and even McCambridge in Galway, where Pat and Owen and Natalie are working away.
And are they family?
They're family. Yeah. Pat was the first cousin of my dad. So they were taken away very young and they haven't had the chance to enjoy their retirement and their family and the business success. So genuinely thinking about your question this morning, I think that would be a lovely, heartfelt recruitment drive, if possible, but it's not.
They'd probably be delighted to see the success.
Hopefully, yeah.
Good. Anyway, Michael McCambridge of McCambridge's Bread, continued success, and thank you for joining us on That Great Business Show.
Thank you, Conal.
You're listening to That Great Business Show. ThatGreatBusinessShow.com.
And as usual, our weekly ask is that you mind our planet, as it's the only one we've got. And it's official, you're not allowed to put shaving foam cans into your green bin. That's why they're all sent to landfill. And that is disgusting and unnecessary. Switching from shaving foam to De Facto, the world's best shaving oil, is all you have to do. One teeny little bottle of De Facto replaces 10 polluting cans of shaving oil. Simple as that. De Facto Shave.
Conobio, at That Great Business Show.
Way before Christmas, on episode 4 of That Great Business Show, we had Chris Deans, boss at Crane Worldwide Logistics Ireland, with us as we tried to find out what might happen to Santa Claus and all his goodies on the run-up to the festive season. Chris correctly forecast that demand would be for smaller turkeys as, due to COVID, family gatherings would also be smaller. And that got a lot of subsequent media attention. Now, as the drumbeat of Brexit and Northern Ireland has started getting louder again, we thought it was a good time to have our A-class forecaster back to studio to see what's happening under the import-export bonnet. And if you're in media, listen up, as the first explosive revelation that Chris has for us is that there's a worldwide shortage of ketchup sachets. Chris Deans of Crane WW, what's going on?
Well, it's interesting on the ketchup side of things. When we talk, I mean, we're in supply chain, so we come up with all weird and wonderful supply chain disruptions and what's happening in the market. But one of the interesting things I read recently was, obviously with COVID and the takeaway food has significantly increased, and in particularly in the US, there's a shortage of ketchup sachets. Because of obviously the shift in change of people's eating habits.
And where would you see that now?
So, I mean, we, BBC, all the regular kind of news channels that we would do, and these articles, just kind of interesting articles, just pop out at you and kind of intrigue you.
But do you see it physically in Crane? Can you see, like, that shipments have been held up or there are no shipments coming from Heinz or whoever is manufacturing this stuff?
Well, I think what you do see is in any supply chain disruption is when demand outweighs supply. And we see that across all industries every day of the week. You've only got to look at, quick example would be if you look at the air freight, if you look at the air and the amount of planes in the sky.
Not many.
Not many at all. But that air freight demand for all that product to run around, to go around the globe is still there. So you've got a surplus in, and it's a really, really challenging time, and it's a really, really interesting time to be in the supply chain industry. If you look at the supply chain industry, typically, not many people would have taken any notice of it. Now we're
correct.
Now we're front and center of pretty much every discussion, and there's just so many different spin-offs to it.
And part of those discussions were it was going to be the end of the world when Brexit happened. That hasn't happened. There were going to be 50-mile-long tailbacks. That has not happened. What is happening?
Lots. I think, like everything, I mean, Brexit, in our industry, in the supply chain, where the disruption, there's opportunity, right? And no doubt Brexit has brought disruption. You just got to look at the volume of traffic in and out of the UK from Dublin Port is down 15% in Q1 this year versus Q1 last year. That's massive in terms of the amount of trucks coming in and out.
But that is probably a lot down to COVID. So COVID hopefully is over. So are you forecasting? Are you?
Well, you've got to look at, if you look at it on the flip side, Ross Lair is up 45% in January this year versus January last year. So there's arguments to and from, but what we have seen is there's a shift in routings. So a lot of people typically would have used the UK land bridge as an option to get into mainland Europe.
Yep.
Now, a lot of companies are looking for an alternative, which would be bypass the UK. Hence, Ross Lair have extra sailing capacity.
And is that working?
Yes, but you're adding about approximately 24 hours to your transit time. So what people are weighing up is there a 24-hour, typically, is there a delay going through the UK land bridge versus short seeing it into the continent and getting to your final destination. So,
and there must be a benefit, though, that your driver can also sleep while he or she is travelling on the sea.
Yeah,
be it up and down, up and down, up and down.
Exactly. <yeah. laughs> But another thing which was really, really interesting, so if you look at our industry, and in particular freight forwarding, so we do bulk freight, heavy freight, air freight, ocean freight, road freight, rail freight, multimodal. But one industry that really kind of surprised me in Brexit and presented itself to us was the jewellery industry in Ireland. Which would surprise most, because if you look at us as a freight forwarder, all of these jewellery goes by courier service.
I wouldn't have known that. Now, are we talking about Claire's accessories, you know, cheap and cheerful?
No, we're talking high-end.
Or high-end. The Rolex watch you're wearing there, yeah?
I wish. But we are talking high-end jewellery. And the reason being is there's a heavy, heavy, heavy demand on the UK for sourcing jewellery into Ireland, but also for repairs.
Okay.
So typically, you send your Rolex to not be repaired in the not mine either to be repaired in the UK.
Okay,
they courier back. Pre-Brexit, that was fine. Post-Brexit, you've got a whole set of different complications. You send something out into the UK, you want to retrieve it back from the UK into Ireland. You've now got the added complexity of customs, of duty and VAT. So we, by default, found ourselves in a situation where we've consulted a lot of these jewellery companies and we've done a lot of bespoke custom solutions for them on the back of Brexit.
How many Rolexes, for example, high-end watches, travel abroad from Ireland every week or year?
You'd probably talk 40 to 50 for a pair, right? So it's relatively small into the UK, but each of those 40 to 50 would have come back in through a courier network pre-Brexit and just been delivered to the end user. Now, all of these jewellers have to figure out who's responsible for customs clearance, who's responsible for the duty, who's responsible for the VAT, how do I do all this? And they were left in a little bit of a pickle and a little bit exposed to, how do I actually do this? How does my business continue? And as those stores open up and this footfall increases in the stores and people come in to get more and more repairs or buy and source more product, that's only going to increase.
What about the Northern Ireland one? They're saying that I can't get my head around it, but sausages, as if the sausages were going to make any darn difference up there. Are you seeing difficulties of people trying to get in and get out goods and services out of Northern Ireland?
No, typically not. It's been a lot of our business is done south of the border in terms of trade. We do, we've got about 4 clients that of north of the border, but we've not had any significant challenges the way Brexit has presented itself down south.
So, are they selling Britain into Northern Ireland?
Yes.
Yeah.
Which is classed essentially as a domestic movement.
Yeah. And then, isn't the big problem though, if they go Britain, Northern Ireland, and we'll stick with sausages, is that they needed to get a sausage load down to Dublin, and then that becomes a cross-border movement.
Yeah, and that's the bit where people have, that's a loophole that people have seen and we've strongly advised against it, right, because...
But even if they were trying to do a loop, sure, is there the capacity to shift, you know, go around in a big loop and transfer... Britain, Northern Ireland, Northern Ireland, Republic of Ireland, and then off down to Europe. You couldn't do that. Be mad.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's crazy. And then you've got the drivers who are on tachographs and have to stop and have to have the brakes and have to have the regular stops, etc. So, yeah, it presents all sorts of challenges.
And they're also low-value items primarily, so probably there's no margin left in it at that stage, is there?
Yeah, and just on that, in terms of I mean, if you look at the sheer volume coming in from UK into Ireland, what you have seen is a significant increase in custom inspections, custom halts. Whereas what the result of that has been is some hauliers, both UK and Ireland hauliers, have refused to carry trail on that lane because they don't want their trailers tied up in Dublin port for 24, 48 hours waiting on the paperwork to be complete. Because they're losing money, and that's an industry where margins are tight.
But what do you do? Do you just refuse the business?
Yeah, a lot of them have looked to diversify their business from an Ireland UK haulier to an Ireland European haulier.
Because they will go across the sea.
They'll go the short sea route, yeah. So you can see, and that kind of plays into what I mentioned earlier on, where if you look at Rosslare's volume up 45% and the extra sailings into the continent as opposed to into Ireland or into the UK. So that's kind of a little bit as to why people would do it.
So I'm hoping, and I'm sure you're hoping as well, that COVID is gone or just about to go. What's the future now? Say, and I'm going to put you on the spot now. What size turkey will we be having for Christmas this coming year? This is June.
Hopefully it's slightly bigger. I think our industry as a whole has had significant challenges. I mean, we've had Brexit, we've had COVID, we've had the Suez Canal not so long ago as well.
But that was temporary.
It was temporary, but it caused massive global disruption because you've already got a shortage of ocean containers and ocean vessels and ocean sailings.
Why is there a shortage of vessels and or containers? I mean, the world must be awash with them. No?
See, and not to get too technical, a lot of the shipping lines now are looking to source the containers themselves. So anyone who has their own containers or are leasing containers, the shipping lines will take their own containers and their own capacity over some of the agents. Therefore, it drives capacity and demand and the rate up, etc. So then you've got, with the air freight, the way it's gone, a lot of people are trying to get to the ocean. Which is driving demand up further. So it's just kind of a perfect storm.
And we were told that shipping rates had gone through the roof because of China, etc. They must be coming off again.
No,
coming down again.
And I don't see that plateauing probably for at least 12 months.
Really?
Yeah, if you look at kind of 400-500% increase on a box on the ocean, air freight.
500%.
Yeah, in some cases, yes. Same with the air freight. The demand has just gone bananas, and we're in a really really volatile, challenging market right now. On global trade has never been as challenged, not in my lifetime anyway.
What other problems are we going to see? Because you're obviously seeing the problems before we do. In terms of either imports or exports?
I think demand is going to continue to be a problem. Cost is going to be a significant problem because where demand outweighs supply, the rates are going to go up and up and up, and the cost of doing business is just going to significantly increase.
Will it make you feel better? The price of oil is keeping going up and up and up. So I presume if you're going on the sea, you're burning oil, so that's another cost for you.
And yeah, but one of the things which is interesting is now a lot of people have turned their attention to rail freight from China. So
where would you do that? Up and around,
up
or something?
And around, yeah, and in and into mainland Europe, and then there's various points within Europe that you connect, and then you kind of obviously for Ireland you would short sea the last mile, but
that must be the longest.
It's actually, don't quote me on the transit time, but I think it's about 18 to 20 days of a transit time into. Now, there's various different change points because of.
I wonder how long those trains are. They must be 2 miles long or something, are they?
I'm not 100% sure of the amount of containers that it goes on, but we've significant surge in particularly in mainland Europe, out of Asia for a lot of that kind of rail freight solution.
Wow. Okay.
So
I could talk to you about this all day.
So you will see, so my tip would be you'll see a surge in rail freight between now and the end of the year, significant surge in rail freight.
I think Warren Buffett owns a couple of railways, railroads over in the States. He's probably, wise man that he is, had seen that 2 years ago and he's making even more money. Before I let you go, I cannot remember who you chose last time. In fact, I don't think we even had it the last time, the Hire in a Heartbeat. Who would you hire in a heartbeat now?
I was thinking about this. I would say Richard Branson would probably be one that
he keeps coming up.
Yeah, I think, I mean, if you look at him, I mean, one of the things that sticks out with Richard Branson for me is there's a long quote he has that he says, if somebody offers you an amazing opportunity and you're unsure how to do it, take it and figure it out. And that kind of mindset and mentality is just kind of refreshing and breathtaking. And I think that kind of entrepreneurial.
I can turn that around because there is an Irish company called Weyhay. They came out of Cork and I think they're now based in London. And what they do is that they have a no dairy ice cream and or something like that. So it's, you know, the whey is gone or something like that. And he has a daughter, I think, who can't take lactic acid or something. And he shipped it all down to Necker. They said, we'll do it. But how do we do it? Because, of course, there's no regular flights down to Necker Island. And so that's they obviously had read the book as well.
Yeah, I think with him, he just, he thinks of an idea and then the solution follows, mm-hmm. Which is really, really refreshing. And it's particularly the way the world is changing.
Okay, well, we'll give Richard a buzz and see if he'll join you. And anyway, you will before, in fact, I hope maybe you might come back to us again before Christmas. I find this stuff so interesting because it is actually a bit of real crystal ball gazing because you do actually see the stuff. But I'm going to spend the next couple of days reading about freight in China now because I find that all very interesting. And Rolexes. I'll have to buy a Rolex first of all to see. Okay, Christine's the boss at Crane WW Worldwide Logistics. Thank you so much for joining us again on That Great Business Show.
Thank you.
It's all go. Let Chrissy know on thatgreatbusinessshow.com. That Great Business Show.
Do the right thing. Ditch dirty, polluting, non-recyclable shaving foam. Switch to defactoshave.com. The only shaving product you need. One nail varnish size bottle lasts a year. Great for your skin, your pocket, and the planet.
Backing great women-led businesses on every show. That Great Business Show.
Jobs people never told you about or that you never knew existed. That's what we're talking about next because I've been chasing my next guest since I set up the podcast, which is around the same time I heard what work Geraldine Kavanagh does. You see, Geraldine is a forager, not just any old forager, if there is such a thing, because Geraldine forages for botanicals that are put into the very, very fine Glendalough gin made in Wicklow. Geraldine's foraging is a lot to do with what gives Glendalough its unique and distinct flavour. Geraldine Kavanagh, welcome. Finally, to That Great Business Show.
Thank you. I finally made it to Dublin after I don't know how many months.
But you had to keep away because you didn't want COVID, and that's understandable.
One of the reasons.
I think you're also avoiding me, but I
know it's the city, not you.
Because you spend 80 or 90% of your time, you just told me this, 80 yeah. or 90% of your time outdoors. You cannot bear being in this little studio.
No, I feel like I'm a caged animal in here. It's actually like a sauna.
Well, it is a bit warm, yeah. But isn't it funny that how people are? I just love this feeling of the studio. But anyways, a forager. How did a person become a forager? Because as I said much earlier in my intro, the careers guidance people do not tell you to become a forager.
No, it's still not really a recognised position. So how did I become a forager? I've always been an outdoors person. So from the time I was a small child, I was always outside.
A little five-year-old, three-year-old?
Always, really. Yeah, okay. I was never really one for watching television or hanging around inside. Now, I would have read books, but apart from that, so I'd be
urban or rural? Where are you?
No, rural. We grew up near Avondale Forest Park, which is 500 acres of just woodland.
And I know it well. It's where Parnell used to live.
Yeah, I love Charles Stewart Parnell. He's one of my favourite figures. So I grew up very near there, and from quite a young age, back in the 70s, we were allowed to, you know, come home from school, jump on our bikes and head off. And we'd always go to Avondale because you could do everything there. You could run along the railway, jump in the river, you know, cycle our bikes and just get up to adventures. But I do feel I was always, you know, noticing plants. And even now I can't go anywhere without seeing plants. I see them everywhere. And I really, without any sort of training, I take them in. And I...
You say without training, but you told me that you got your first book 27 years ago.
Yeah.
So you've 27 years of training, if you like, under your belt.
Yeah.
Plus that mad keenness to learn more and more and more.
Yeah. So I wouldn't have had a teacher growing up. So when I was in my teens, I remember... I must have picked up a little wildflower book and I remember flicking through it. I still have that book. It's one of those old, you know, hardbound books. And I remember thinking, oh, I know where to find all those plants. You know, I didn't know what they were called, but it's like, oh, that one grows down near the river in Avondale, or this one grows near that old ruined cottage. Or so I knew plants before I knew their names. And so as I was a teenager, I started to learn the names of plants and then kind of got involved with food and...
That's the jump. We can always look at flowers.
Yeah.
But what was the jump into the food business?
So, after I finished secondary school, I went to Trinity College and I studied Russian and French. And I went to Russia and I was back on a break from Russia because sadly my grandmother died while I was there and I had to come back while I was on an Erasmus year or a break year at St. Petersburg State University. And I came back and some new people had moved into a farm down the road and... they had heard about me. I actually had 20 goats before I left for Russia and I used to walk the goats on the lead round the road and I was very into plants. And so they'd heard about me and said, she sounds like she might come and work on our organic farm when she gets back. So I did. And then my life kind of changed after that. I actually dropped out of college and I used to just spend all my time working on the farm. And I ended
speaking
up then,
French and Russian to the goats.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, they were fluent. So I ended up for a good few years then just working in different food businesses. Like when I was quite young, I was the manager at the Good Food Store with Vanessa Clark, who's still an amazing purveyor of the finest every food you can think of. I worked for two of the best organic farmers in the country, Dennis Healy, who has Organic Delights, and Mark Michelle, who has Organic Life. So I worked for them, working on the farms. And then with Mark, I worked setting up, going from a shed, basically, to a farm shop and restaurant, which was award-winning. And then after that, I had a baby. I have three children now, but when I had my first child, Lucy, I was working on the farm and the day came for me to go back to work and I was still breastfeeding. So I brought my husband and the baby with me. And then I realized at that day that I could not go back to work because I had a baby and my life was different. I was really like 110% committed to the work I was doing there. And I knew I couldn't do that anymore. I couldn't do it properly. And I really wanted to just be at home. So we decided I was going to be a stay-at-home mum. So I did that for a number of years. And then we were outside a lot. All along that time, I was learning more and more about plants. I was learning about foraging. And my friend had given me a book when I was 19. So that was like 11 years earlier. And so I remember one day in May, I had three children at that stage. I was just looking around. I was looking at all the amazing wild food that's just growing there in the hedgerow. And I was like, you know, so many people don't know about this anymore. And that information is getting lost. And it's very much lost over the past few generations. So I thought, maybe I'll take a couple of friends out on Saturday. So I said to a couple of friends, usually the mums at school, do you want to come out for a foraging walk on Saturday? I'll make you lunch. And they came out.
You'll pick your own lunch is what you really mean.
Yeah, well, I would have prepared stuff in advance, but we would have picked stuff as well. So that was really successful. And then later, the following week, some more of my friends and some of the mums were coming over saying, could I go out with you? And that's basically how my business was born.
Because that is part of the business. Now, obviously, COVID has done for that for a while, but you are coming back into that now.
Yeah, so...
And what is that called?
It's called Wicklow Wild Foods.
Okay.
So I started that, I think, in 2011. And it wasn't very popular at the time. There was I don't think there was anyone doing foraging walks at the time in Ireland. And two or three people had turned up on a Saturday and I'd still, even if there was one person, I'd still give 100%, you know, and there'd be sometimes two of us walking around, you know, for 4 hours and we'd have lunch outside. And that really just grew organically. And now I could do that every day of the week and I'm booked
because
out.
Because of the amount of people who are interested in doing it.
Fantastic. Like when I started out, there was no Google. And when I started my business, there was no Instagram, no Facebook, no nowhere really to learn. If you wanted to look up stuff online, it was more like being a researcher. So it wasn't that easy to advertise. So I started up doing the foraging walks and then I started my own market stall. So I had a fantastic market stall with kids helping out, picking mushrooms, selling soups and all sorts of weird stuff.
Where were you doing that?
I was at McCredden, and I was at festivals and like the Tin Healy Agricultural Show, which was usually my best day of the year.
And just branded as?
Wicklow Wild Foods. Okay. Yeah, it's been the same name all along. And my husband is a graphic designer, web designer, photographer, so he's looked after all of the technical side of stuff and making my logo and everything like that. So he looks after all of that for me for free.
Which brings us to becoming a picker of botanicals for Glendalough Gin.
Yeah, so how that happened was a lovely reporter came out from the Irish Times, whose name I forgot, and she came out one Saturday with her mum, and we had a really nice walk, and she brought her mum with her, and we had lunch outside, and then that article was put into the paper in April 2014, I think. It was to coincide with the visit to Ireland of René Redzepi of Noma Restaurant, which was at the time voted best restaurant in the world. And the main thing about Noma, and they're still going today, and one day I hope to go there, is that all of their food is found locally. They grow a little and they forage almost everything, and it's just unbelievable. So I was in the paper just to coincide with his visit to Ireland. Then Gary McLaughlin, of one of the founders of Glendalough Distillery, was reading the paper, and they had gotten a new still. Like, they were selling their poteen and whiskey. I think they were founded in about 2011. And he was reading the paper, and they'd got this new still, and it was for gin, and there wasn't the gin boom, and there was nobody doing botanicals back then. There was only like three gins in Ireland maybe at the time. And so they wanted to make that gin have something to do with Wicklow. How could it be connected to Wicklow? And Gary said he read the paper and he was like, oh, we could just get in touch with Geraldine and ask her to maybe put some plants in. So I remember the following Monday, I was hanging the clothes on the line because I had my three small kids and I was busy at home. And I remember this call from Glendalough Distillery, Barry Gallagher, who became my boss, called me up and said, look, we have this distillery in Glendalough Distillery, which I had never heard of, although it was just down the road. And they said, look, we have this still, and we were wondering if you could help us to come up with a recipe for a gin that's using local botanicals. And so we had a long chat, a really nice chat, and I really liked him from the start, you know. And I said, yeah, no problem, we'll do that. And then I put the phone down. I was like, I haven't a clue what I'm doing here. I don't even know how gin is actually made. I know there's juniper, but how does it get in? When does it get in? I haven't a clue. So I just winged it. And we probably all did a little bit. And so they gave me a rough idea of how much, you know, alcohol, how much liquid was going in, maybe roughly how much juniper they're planning to use, so on, the base recipe. And they said, maybe you can work on what botanicals might go well with that. So,
and how do you choose a botanical? I mean,
well, I know, like, if you say to me, can you go out there and find me something that tastes of like lemon, or can you find me something in the wild that tastes like vanilla or almond, or even can you find me something that smells like chocolate, because I haven't found anything that tastes like chocolate, but I can go, yeah, no problem. So I know if I'm walking down the road or walking through a forest, I know the taste of everything that's there.
Fantastic.
And that's what I do on Saturdays. Like, I give people things to taste and they're like, oh my God, I never imagined you could get that flavour just from those green plants there in the hedgerow. So coming up with the recipe was really not that difficult for me, because I have been working with food all my life, and I find it very easy to, like, if you say to me, could you find something that's going to go well with that? I'd be like, yeah, I can imagine it, you know.
Yeah, okay, but you're now moving kind of into an industrial scale.
Well, no, at the start it was very small.
Because if you're trying to get consistency, if I get one bottle, it has to taste like the other 1,000 bottles.
Yeah. So how we started off was we made a batch or two of gin. The guys, basically, they all came down one Saturday a little while after, because I said, well, the botanicals that I want to use will be out. It's probably around this time of year, actually, because I remember we put elderflower into it and roses and clover and pine and things like that. So it was around this time of year. The guys came down, gave them all of the ingredients. They went away to the distillery, and then we spoke a day or two later, and I said, so how did that gin turn out? And they're like, oh my God, it's amazing. And we were all very excited. Like, it didn't even need to be tweaked or anything, the recipe.
Had you written it down?
Yeah.
Or had you just chucked a few things in?
Oh, it was all a bit haphazard. Like, no, we wrote everything down. And of course, when the guys got to the distillery, they're very meticulous. You have to record everything. So it would have been recorded. And I think we might have made one or two batches of gin. And then a problem arose, which is that with wild food, like I brought a few things in my basket there. There's elderflower and clover and there's roses and honeysuckle. And the problem with wild food is that you can't buy it in the shops. And once it's gone out of season,
it's gone.
It's gone. And yeah, it won't be back till next year. So I kind of had to say, well, that's all well and good. The gin is lovely, but we're not going to be able to make much more. I think we only made 2,000 bottles that year. But the guys were very creative, real creative bunch and very innovative. And I mean, our motto is stand apart. So it wasn't a big issue. So someone said, well, see, what we were starting to call this gin, we hadn't decided. We were going to call it the Upper Lake Gin because, it's, you know, we're connected to Glenlough. And then someone said, well, could we do like a Lower Lake Gin or something? And I was like, yeah, okay. And then we slowly came around to the idea, well, we could say this is a summer gin because it is a summer gin, and we could do an autumn gin. So I think it was in November that year, Kevin, who's our brilliant creative director, called me from Poland and said, I'm getting all the labels printed for all the bottles that we're going to make next year. And can you tell me the recipes for the other three gins? And this was in November when there was nothing to pick. And I was like, okay. And I said, could you give me a little while? So,
because of course this had to go onto the label.
Yeah. So I sat down and I was like, okay, so it's April, springtime, because there's a little period in the winter when there isn't really much to pick. So what am I going to smell in April if I'm at the Upper Lake? So there's gorse there on the...
And this is all in your head?
All in my head, yes.
Fantastic.
So there's gorse there on the lake shore. I know that I'm going to smell a lovely sort of fresh kind of minty green smell that you get in springtime, especially, and then the smell of the pine and the spruce and the fir. So because I'd already done the summer gin and it worked out so well, we'd a rough idea of quantities of what you'd need. So I wrote down the recipe for spring, and then we didn't need summer, and then autumn and winter. Like autumn, I was thinking, you know, you get smell like sort of dried herbs and all the different wild fruit that you get at autumn. Winter was slightly difficult because there isn't a lot to forage. But then we sort of thought about like wintertime in Ireland and the kind of food you'd be eating and the kind of cakes you'd make and the spices like, you know, caraway and clove and cinnamon, things you'd use in your brack and your Christmas cake and your Christmas pudding along with the wild food that would be around. So that was a nice kind of had a spicy finish on it. So basically all the recipes were written up, and then we kind of had to wait till the following year to see how they all turned out. And to be honest, they've really not been changed at all, really. We might have left out one or two ingredients that proved too difficult to be picking, but...
Which goes to the next question is, they've got the recipes.
Yeah.
Do they need their forager?
They do.
That's what you say.
Well, I'm not only a forager, like we all... Like, I would be involved in tasting the gin.
Now, is it you? Have you got exceptional taste? I was thinking
about
that. I do.
Yeah, I do. I'm the one at home where my husband's like, can you smell that meat and see if it's okay?
Yeah.
See if it says it's still in date, and I've got a very good nose. And I
nose
can,
or palate?
Everything, yeah. I can smell a lot and I can taste a lot. I know I can. Like, I used to be an au pair in France and I was the one who was always picked in this big old stone-walled house to find out where was the dead mouse. Like, and I'd have to go off and sniff out the mouse. And, you know, I just have a good nose and I have a really good palate. And it's probably not as good as it was, like, when I was younger, but still I still have to taste the gins regularly and sign off everything and make sure that everything tastes
good.
There is
a career for you and obviously, but and for others in foraging?
Yeah, I mean, it's not simple. I mean, I could take you out now and I could give you one leaf or two leaves and you would die. So, you know,
okay.
this is what I teach.
Alison inside says, yeah, go do it.
So like on Saturdays when I do my foraging walks, I always make sure that I tell people about, I always do, like, I'll even do detours to show them about really dangerous plants. Like we have one plant we look at on every walk and it's really common, but a small amount of it would kill you. And it's
digitalis,
one of the most,
is it? Or no?
Well, no, that's very poisonous as well. That would kill you also.
Just showing off. Just
yeah, no digital. We always look at the foxglove. It's a very beneficial plant because it keeps people alive because it alters your heart rate. But we look at this other one called hemlock water dropwort, which a lot of people think, oh, that looks like wild celery or wild parsley, but a very small amount of it's going to completely destroy your nervous system and you're going to die. So
okay,
we always
go away from that one, all right?
Well, we always look at it. We don't touch it, but we always look at it and we always make sure that everyone's not going to forget it.
So now there are two questions or three questions left.
Yeah.
One. Your business, people. When are you open for business yet?
I
walks?
Opened up as soon as I could, and yeah, we were doing the walks. We're keeping it to less than 15 people, and we're doing. To be honest, they're booked out now for the whole summer.
Get away!
I think. Yeah.
Well done, you.
Yeah,
Yeah. Fantastic.
And then I should have gotten on to say about the Wild Botanical Gin. Because I didn't finish the story. So when we continued making those four seasonal gins, it proved kind of difficult after 2 years, you know, because consistency wasn't really an issue because everyone was happy to get, oh my God, a very rare bottle with the numbers written and the dates written on and, you know, everything very handmade. But when we wanted to scale up and, you know, some shops were, you know, they would say we want the spring gin in autumn and we'd say you can't get it, you have to wait. So we spent 2 years creating the Wild Botanical Gin, which is a gin that we make over 9 months of the year. So we forage each ingredient separately over the year, distill it separately. We had to kind of create a new way.
Yeah, there's a kind of a one consistent brand all our line all the way through.
Following a very exact recipe. So that was launched in 2017, and then that became, I don't think the guys even expected that the gin would become like maybe even up to 50% of the business, because obviously there was all the whiskies and the poaching as well, but the gin became so successful. It's now on sale in 45 countries.
Wow.
And it just won
45 countries.
Yeah. It just won double gold at the San Francisco World Spirits Competition. And double gold is when all of the judges award a gold medal. So it's a blind tasting, so it's only based on the liquid.
Well done, all of you.
Yeah, we're very happy.
Fantastic.
We're delighted. And we also just won Irish Distillery of the Year at the New York International Spirits Competition, and that's never even been given before. So it's really nice because we're all working very hard, or I'm working away on my own, and you know, the Rowdy, our distiller, and our assistant distillers. It's just really nice to have.
Will any of the three kids become foragers?
They're all teenagers and just about to become teenagers, so nothing I do is cool at the moment.
Okay, yeah.
But I'm actually very happy that they do know their stuff. Like, they were actually selling mushrooms to restaurants when they were 3, 5 and 7. So
brilliant.
Yeah, they sold their first porcini when they could hardly see over the table.
And be careful that they don't put that water, did you call it a water wart or a...
No, they won't, don't worry.
Into mom's little cocktail.
Yeah.
Final question. Who would you hire in a heartbeat to work with you?
My husband would probably say that I'll answer Aidan Turner, and I probably would.
Well, he might know you, so.
He doesn't know me yet.
No, I mean your husband.
Oh. To be honest, I love working on my own. So I can't think
of
anyone.
What? That's the best answer we've been given so far. I love it.
I love working on my own. I'm out on my own, out in nature, with my own thoughts, and I'm very happy. So I do have assistance sometimes in the summer. Like, I had this wonderful girl, Yona, last year, and we had so much fun. So probably Yona.
No, stick with the one that I like, which is yourself.
Yeah.
I love
No,
that
I'm
one.
Happy working on my own. Yeah.
Geraldine, I'm so happy that you came in, because that is fantastic. That's such a great story. It's so interesting. And continued and massive success to Glendalough Gin, particularly because I know a business that they were very, very kind to just a couple of years ago.
Oh.
And they are, you know, you give it, what is it, the term? You pay it forward. And they were paying it forward. And I wish them every success. Mm. And you guys, all the whole lot of you there. So well done.
Thank you.
That is Geraldine Kavanagh. She be the forager for Glendalough Distillery. And if you want to go out with Geraldine, as she just said, just booked out. It's fantastic. Good for you. And that is it from That Great Business Show on this, our 38th episode. As always, my thanks to the team here at Dublin South FM Podcast Studios. Sound engineer Alison O'Dwyer tells me she's off foraging around the Dundrum Shopping Centre where our studios are based. Later, head of Stings and Segways, Peter Rice, will make sure we remain officially the world's best sounding podcast. Today's Griff Mahagi goes to James Doyle at the Hive Agency for securing Geraldine. Maeve Nifsey sent us Tanya Thompson. Kate Yates, head of comms at Crane WW, has already been telling her worldwide colleagues about Christine that he was joining us. And finally, Aidan Long at Love Irish Food introduced me to Michael McCambridge. Thanks, wichas, to you all. And keep them coming. If you are a PR or not a PR and you want a client or a friend or a business to feature on That Great Business Show, contact us on producer@thatgreatbusinessshow.com. You'll also find all the details of what we're looking for on the website on the Share Your Story button. We are in business, so if you're in business, why not tell others about it by advertising on the only business podcast that does business differently. Do also follow us on our LinkedIn pages, where we have some bonus material, including our sneak peek every week. Finally, my thanks to our sponsor, DeFactoShave.com, the world's best shaving oil. Try it for a week, and like me, you will be a forever convert. So for me, Conal O'Moran, until next week, Slán tomhle.